everybody. Thank you very much for coming today. It's very nice to look out to see a number of familiar faces in the audience. Welcome, everyone. The observant of you, observant ones among you, will spot very quickly that I am not Tamsin Allen. Unfortunately, she had to pull out yesterday for personal reasons. She was very sorry she couldn't attend. My name is Guy Basil Adams. I'm a barrister at Matrix Chambers, and I've been involved in a number of cases where privacy and data protection issues have been at the centre of the case. Quite recently in the phone hacking litigation on the defendant side, and more recently in the blacklisting litigation on the claimant side. Kirsten Sewell from Matrix Chambers has standing in for Ben Silverston, who was originally slated to do the slot. She has prepared a paper which she is going to talk to, which outlines some of the key principles. And what we're proposing to do then is we've got two case studies. Hopefully you should all have them now. And we're going to suggest that you have 10 minutes after Kirsten's done her presentation to look at those, discuss them amongst yourselves, and then we'll open it up and have a debate about those case studies. And then at the end, I am going to conclude with offering some observations on recent developments which I think are interesting in privacy and data protection and how they feed into tactical strategic considerations when you're formulating a claim. So with those introductory remarks, I'll hand over to Kirsten.
Yes, as Guy said, I've prepared a paper which you should all hopefully have. You only got it this morning. And I'm going to talk to it, but not exhaustively go through it, because there's quite a lot of detail in there, and I certainly wouldn't want to bore you with it all today. In essence, the paper just sets out the principal civil causes of action that one might have against a public authority in privacy and data protection claims. So I'm going to discuss, first of all, the Data Protection Act, an obvious one. But I'm also going to touch upon the torts of misuse of private information, breach of confidence, and also briefly on harassment as well. Harassment's becoming something which we see increasingly used as a cause of action, both in the form of anti-harassment injunctions and subsequently as damages actions. I think I can say that the overarching principle, guiding principle, whether it be a public authority or not, is Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights when one's talking about privacy. Article 8, as I'm sure you all know, protects the right to private and family life. It also includes reputation. But that really will be the kind of cornerstone, and that's what all of the legislation in the UK really is aimed at being compatible with. So the Data Protection Act talks of misuse of private information, breach of confidence, all really incorporate the principles enshrined in Article 8 of the European Convention. So turning first to the Data Protection Act, and you can see in the paper, this starts on page 2 and continues. Now the Data Protection Act I've termed as the UK's privacy statute. The UK doesn't have a kind of general private law or otherwise action of misuse of privacy. There's no kind of general privacy statute, but I think you can pretty well describe the Data Protection Act as the UK's privacy statute. It sets out a number of, there are 8 data protection principles which you must comply with when you're processing data, personal data. It's a criminal offence under the Act not to process, to unlawfully obtain or disclose personal data. Personal data being described in the Act under Section 1 as anything relating to an identifiable living individual. As I said, there are a number of principles, and public authorities have to comply with those principles when they're processing, obtaining personal data. But I think the overarching principle that one can take away is one of fairness. You have to do things fairly with personal data. And you have to obviously do things lawfully as well. Now, I've set out here the 8 data protection principles at page 2. And I won't go through all of them now. You can see them in the paper and they're there for reference. Some of these may well be quite useful when we go on to consider the case studies. I've also set out the purposes for which data can be lawfully processed. And again, you can see that there's quite a wide and non-cumulative list there. So things like individual has consented to the processing of their personal data, it's necessary because of an employment contract, or it's necessary because of a legal obligation, or the quite wide phrase vital interest, so necessary to protect the individual's vital interests. But you may also have you may also be able to lawfully and fairly process data for the purpose of protecting other people's vital interests. And again, these might be things to consider when we come on to consider the case studies. Someone else's vital interest might be, for example, the prevention of crime or the protection of the rights and freedoms of another person. So to process someone's personal data in order to protect the competing rights of another individual, for example. So the principles, I think, are deliberately widely phrased and quite vague. It will be a fact-sensitive exercise when you look at whether you're fairly and lawfully processing someone's personal data. It's always going to be a balancing act. And again, that's when I'd come back to Article 8 of the European Convention, because you have to think, is what you're doing fair, lawful, proportionate, because you're interfering with someone's right to privacy when you are processing personal data. One thing I did want to touch on briefly is the difference between ordinary personal data and sensitive personal data. Now, sensitive personal data are things like medical information. And if you're processing someone's sensitive personal data, then you have additional obligations, and those are set out in Schedule 3 of the Act. And you can see those purposes set out at page 3 of my paper, and you can have a look at those in your own time. I've also provided, you should all have a copy, I hope, of the Data Protection Act Order of 2000, which expands further on the purposes for which sensitive personal data can lawfully and fairly be processed. There are a number of things in there, including legitimate interests of others, but you'll also see that if there is a substantial public interest in the processing or disclosing of sensitive personal data, then you may be able to justify it. Now, what is substantial public interest? It's rather unhelpfully not defined anywhere. But it may be things like national security, the prevention of a serious crime, all of those sorts of things. But again, that's another kind of catch-all purpose which may save a public authority who has otherwise done something which looks on the face of it like it would be unlawful with some of the sensitive personal data. So that's a very, very brief overview of the data protection principles and purposes for which you can lawfully process someone's information. And I've mentioned it already that Section 55 of the Act creates a criminal offence. But of course, today we're talking about private law, and what the Act also does is set out a means by which individuals can obtain compensation under the Act. So that's Section 13 of the Data Protection Act. Provides a remedy for any individual who suffers damage by reason of any contravention by a data controller of any of the requirements of the Act. Now, Guy's going to come on a bit later to talk about what damage is and whether that's limited to purely financial damage. But it is a useful remedy to have in mind. It's quite a wide-reaching remedy, any breach of the Act. You can bring a claim for compensation. I've set out a little bit further on page 5 of the paper some of the requirements that you would need to show in order to bring a claim under Section 13. So the first, obviously, you'd have to show there's been a breach of the Data Protection Act by a data controller. Now, a data controller is defined as any person who determines the purposes for which and the manner in which any personal data are or are to be processed. So that's sort of step one. It'll be fairly self-explanatory in most cases, and it won't generally provide much of an obstacle to a Data Protection Act claim. one thing that should be borne in mind is that data has to be part of a relevant filing system or electronically processed. So in terms of relevant relevant filing system, it's a very narrow definition. And following a case called Smith against Lloyd Bank PLC, which is a 2005 decision, it doesn't include unstructured bundles kept in boxes, and that's even if they've been previously accessed electronically. So relevant filing system is something that you have to sort of, I mean, it won't be an issue generally in relation to public authorities. Most things are processed electronically these days anyway. But if, for example, a public authority has employed a private investigator to obtain information about an individual and he's just kept it in kind of loose leaf journals, you may run into some difficulty with the technical requirements under Section 13. So that's just something to bear in mind, because it's quite a narrow definition. As I said, guides will be going to deal with damage, but what I do want to say about that is that the traditional position under the Data Protection Act that damage has to be financial damage. So you couldn't bring a claim for mere distress or anxiety, and that is something which claimants have often struggled with, because one can imagine that more frequently Data Protection Act breaches are not going to produce any significant financial damage, maybe nominal damage. But what's really going to have been the issue is the distress, the anxiety, the moral damage, if you like, that's been caused by the unlawful processing or disclosure of your personal information. That has started to change recently, and as Guy will come on to say a little bit about later, it looks as if the courts are now starting to open up to the idea of mere distress as a source of damage, so it may become easier for claimants to bring claims under the Data Protection Act. But that's something we'll talk about a bit later on, but just something to flag up at this stage to bear in mind. I've also set out some of the exceptions to financial damage, but they aren't generally going to apply in the case of public authorities. It's things like journalistic purposes, artistic purposes, etc. So that's a sort of whistle-stop tour of the exciting world of the Data Protection Act and the civil remedies that are available under it. I'll move on, before you get far too overstimulated with data protection, it happens quite frequently, to talk about breach of confidence, which is one of the heads of privacy talks which has developed in English law in recent years. Now, breach of confidence, I mean, it's essentially when one person misuses private information that belongs to another. And it's information that has a necessary quality of confidence about it. It has to be imparted in circumstances importing an obligation of confidence, and the use of it has to be unauthorised, and it has to be to the detriment of the party, authorised use of the detriment to the use of the party communicating it. So this sort of necessary quality of confidence was historically quite a narrow definition, and there was, for example, a prohibition on information that was merely trivial or useless. So one can imagine, for example, information which is very personal to you, but actually isn't really confidential information. It's not business secrets. It's the fact that you may have some sort of embarrassing secret that you wouldn't necessarily want anyone to know about, but the courts wouldn't attribute a necessary quality of confidence to that information. And yes, it used to be generally information that had to have some kind of commercial value. Now, the duty is circumstances in which a duty of confidence will be imposed. I mean, it's generally any circumstance where you would have a reasonable expectation of confidence. So you tell police officer X something which is very sensitive and important relating to the commission of an offence by another. That information clearly has some quality of confidence about it. You impart it to the police officer, you say, "I don't want to be named," and the police officer then discloses everything about it to the general public. Those sorts of circumstances, I think, would fall within the remit of breach of confidence. The third element is misuse of that information, and that's quite misleading, because actually you don't have to use the information at all now. The mere obtaining of confidential information has now been recognised by the courts as something which can trigger a claim for breach of confidence. So you don't actually have to do anything at all with the information you've obtained. Merely being in receipt of it unlawfully is enough for the tool to breach your confidence, although question whether you're going to get much in the way of damages when nothing's been done with the information at all. Things have somewhat moved on and overtaken. I mean, breach of confidence is still a viable claim, but probably the more common means by which you would bring an action for misuse of for breach of privacy would be misuse of private information. And misuse of private information has kind of developed in English law and has absorbed and incorporated the domestic and European jurisprudence on Article 8 of the European Convention. It's very similar to breach of confidence, except that the definition of information which is private is slightly wider, because it is incorporated, as I say, Article 8. So anything which under Article 8 would be considered private information would come within the remit of misuse of private information. So anything over which you would have a reasonable expectation of privacy. So going back to my embarrassing secret before, which would be quite trivial to most of the world, but very sensitive and very personal to me, would come under that umbrella. That's something that triggers my right to private life under Article 8, and the disclosure of it would be an interference with my right to private life under Article 8. So misuse of private information is broader because it incorporates the Strasbourg and the domestic jurisprudence on Article 8. And so, of course, because it engages Article 8, you can also look at justifying the interference under Article 8 too. So, for example, a public authority receives information which is private about an individual. It relates to benefits fraud, for example. And it contains, within that information, there's a lot of personal information about the individual which he wouldn't want to be disclosed. Clearly Article 8 is engaged. Clearly disclosing that information or otherwise using the information would be an interference with my Article 8 rights. But the public authority may well be able to say, well, under Article 8 too, that interference is necessary, proportionate, pursuit of legitimate aim, prevention, detection of crime. So that's a very kind of oversimplified way of describing misuse of private information. But it is always really going to be a balancing act. Has there been an interference with the right to private life under Article 8? Yes. Well, can I nonetheless justify it under Article 8 too? Or can I say that the disclosure of the information is necessary because it engages, for example, Article 10, freedom of expression? Now, I think that freedom of expression is going to be harder for a public authority to rely on, or public interest as part of that, than, for example, a journalist. And that's because public authorities are held to a slightly higher standard, because, of course, they have to act compatibly with the Human Rights Act 1998. There's no sort of science to it, but I do think it would be more difficult for a public authority to come along and say, well, I'm justified in disclosing this person's name to the media because my right to freedom of expression under Article 10 enables me to do so. Well, they may be able to do it under Article 8 too, because they may be able to say, I was justified in disclosing that person's name to the media because we wanted to be able to identify that person, we wanted the public to know who they were, and it was for a legitimate aim. But I think Article 10 would be more difficult. And that's something that we may want to discuss and touch upon when we come to the case studies later. So yes, I've touched upon information sharing and the need to balance the interference with the right to private family life with things like Article 10. I've mentioned in the paper a case from 2003 from Strasbourg, that's Peck against the United Kingdom. Many of you may be familiar with it. This concerned an individual who was suffering from quite severe depression. He was walking down a main street. I'm getting a time warning here. This was essentially an example of a public authority being found to have unlawfully interfered with the individual's right to private family life under Article 8, even though surveillance was carried out in a public place, even though there were arguable public interest grounds. It's something to consider. You can look at it in your own time. But it's really quite an important case in the context of privacy, Article 8, misuse of private information. I've also given you some examples of where the European Court, things the European Court has considered in the balancing exercise in the context of photographs. Again, if you do a lot of work with public authorities, you may well find that this issue comes up quite a lot. Taking of surveillance photographs of members of the public, for example, those photos being leaked. So that's one, Hanover. Number two, that's set out in some detail in the paper. I mentioned harassment as well as the sort of final headline point. Governing legislation here is the Protection from Harassment Act. I've set out section one of the Act there, which sort of contains all of the ingredients of the tort. Essentially, you must not pursue a course of conduct which amounts to the harassment of the other and which you knew or ought to have known amounted to the harassment of another person. So it has to be something that's a course of conduct, but in the context of public authority, situations where that may arise, kind of concentrated surveillance over a long period of time over an individual may amount to harassment. That individual may then be entitled to obtain an anti-harassment injunction to prevent the behaviour from continuing, or equally may be able to sue after that and obtain damages. Again, may be able to claim damages for distress, not simply financial loss in respect of harassment. I'll stop there because I want to give us some time to actually discuss the case study. There's much more in the paper than I've been able to go into orally. Have a read of it in your own time. I think what might be helpful now is for you to have a read of the case studies yourselves and give you sort of 5 to 10 minutes to do that. And then I think it would be quite useful for us to just talk about it in some of the issues as a group and consider some of the causes of action that we might consider in each case. Thanks.
Please do feel free to discuss the case studies amongst yourselves.
Yes, it's not an exam.
You haven't taken a vow of silence. It's not an exam. It's not about getting it right. It's about just identifying the main causes of action and having a bit of a debate about how to balance out the various factors.
And if anyone has any questions when you're reading, Guy and I would be happy to.
What we suggest is after having had a quick read through, maybe you discuss it a bit amongst yourselves, and if you want to say that there's one person on the table who will, you know, take the lead in responding or answering questions, weren't very happy with that approach. Equally, if people want to pop up their hand when I ask a question, happy with that too. So you do feel you can discuss them and debate them a bit. Should we start with case? I'm just conscious that we would like to have some time to debate the case studies and a bit of time left at the end as well. So if this is a good moment, can we start with case study one? And who would like to kick off by identifying what potential claims there are against the council?
Breach of Article 8, breach of the Data Protection Act, and also the privacy issues.
Yes. So, in relation to the council, there are various stages. They record the footage, and then they pass it on to the police, and they also pass it on to the neighbourhood watch group. So potentially there are claims against the council in relation to passing the footage on to the police and in relation to passing it on to the neighbourhood watch group. And the starting point under the Data Protection Act is looking at the threshold conditions. So it is personal data because the claimant is identifiable. It's sensitive personal data because it relates to the alleged commission of an offence. The council is clearly a data controller under the Data Protection Act. And the council processes the personal data by passing it on to the police and indeed onto the neighbourhood watch. Now, in terms of the council
looking from the council's perspective in terms of justifications under the Data Protection Act, what does anyone have any comments what they would, might seek to rely on in this context? Firstly, for passing it on to the police.
Prevention of crime.
That's right. So there was a separate handout of the statutory instrument which looked at Schedule 3 conditions. Schedule 3 relates to sensitive personal data. And in addition to the general provision in Schedule 3 of the Act relating to processing for the purpose of the administration of justice or in relation to contemplated legal proceedings, which could apply, could both apply, you will see that on page 2 of the order, regulation Article 1 it provides that sensitive personal data may be processed where it is in the substantial public interest and is necessary for the purposes of the prevention or detection of any unlawful act and must necessarily be carried out without the explicit consent of the data subject being sought so as not to prejudice those purposes. So that's something that the council might rely on in relation to disclosure to the police. And then potentially Regulation 2, you can see there, again the processing is in the substantial public interest, necessary for the discharge of any function which is designed for protecting members of the public, and that's quite widely defined, dishonesty, malpractice or other seriously improper conduct by any person. Well, query whether there would be seriously improper conduct in the context of a man who has essentially shouted and banged on the door of the shop. It might be said that that was a disproportionate disclosure under the Data Protection Act to disclose the CCTV footage to the neighbourhood watch, but they would probably have a greater justification in relation to the police. In addition, I think, so that's looking at it from the prism of the Data Protection Act now. If we look at it from the prism of Article 8, there is, to an extent, an overlap with the facts of the Peck case. So the first question is Article 8 engaged at each of the different stages? Now, what they said in Peck was that if you're wandering around in a public place, you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in general terms. You will be observed by other people, and you don't have an expectation that your data won't be recorded, that your movements won't be monitored by CCTV. But as soon as a permanent record is kept, your Article 8 rights are engaged, and as soon as any use is made by a public authority of the footage, again, your Article 8 rights will be engaged by that use. And so certainly Article 8 will be engaged in this case by the council providing the footage to the police and indeed by providing it to the neighbourhood watch. And then we have to ask ourselves in terms of Article 8 2 justifications, we would be looking at, again, the similar considerations, public safety, prevention of disorder or crime, the rights of others, the well-known Article 8 2 exceptions. But the question would be necessity and proportionality again. And there, again, you might feel that different considerations arise in relation to disclosure to the police and disclosure to the neighbourhood watch, because disclosure to the police is for the purpose of enabling the police to carry out an investigation, whereas and there's a very strong public interest in the police being given uninhibited access to materials for that purpose. What is, however, providing it to the neighbourhood watch in circumstances where this man hasn't even been charged with an offence, let alone convicted of an offence, seems to me to be arguably disproportionate, and you might potentially have a claim against the council in relation to that aspect of it. So that's looking at the council aspect. Who would like to say something about the starting points in relation to the police aspect? So what we're talking about in relation to the police are really
two discrete things, aren't we? We're talking about the fact that firstly he's placed under surveillance, and then we're talking about the fact that this footage is added, that his details are added, and the footage is added to the National Domestic Extremism Database.
The police surveillance, would it form an harassment provision potentially?
That's quite a tricky area, because in order to bring a claim in harassment, you have to show that you've suffered alarm and distress as a consequence of a course of conduct being pursued. And if surveillance is done properly, you're not aware of the fact of the surveillance at the time that it's being carried out. So that can give rise to issues about whether undertaking surveillance in the normal course of events amounts to harassment. It can do in certain circumstances where people become aware of the surveillance at the time and it continues, or in circumstances where they're aware of it at the time and distressed by it and become, or distressed by the suspicion of it and become distressed again at a later date when they receive confirmation that it has taken place. But there is a real issue there around what happens when people are not aware. But certainly, where a public authority is following you around and making a record of your movements, that engages your rights under the Data Protection Act, because they're obtaining and recording information about you, and it engages your rights under Article 8 of the Convention. And so again, we're in the... in addition, there is a complicating factor we don't need to go into, which is that the use of those kind of investigatory powers is regulated by the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, which provides for quite a comprehensive schedule as well. But for our purposes, looking at it from the prism of bringing a civil claim against the police, the issue would be, the focus would be, was their conduct necessary and proportionate in pursuit of a legitimate aim? That's under Article 8. And in relation to the Data Protection Act, have they processed that data fairly and lawfully? And I think it might well be said that there's a real difference here between the surveillance element and the placing of the material on the extremism database. Again, the surveillance element, query whether that is really proportionate given the relatively modest, how can I put it, undramatic conduct of the person concerned. Is it really proportionate to go following him around for days? This isn't a person who has committed some very serious criminal offence. In fact, it doesn't look to me like he's committed any criminal offence. So I think there is a real question about the proportionality even of that. But certainly adding him to the National Extremism Database, it would be very hard to argue that that was proportionate. And it would be very hard to argue that it would be a fair processing of his data for the purpose of the Data Protection Act. I also debated with Kirsten on the way down whether it would give rise to a claim for whether it might give rise to a discrimination claim. It might give rise to potentially a libel claim as well, depending on who was able to access the National Extremism Database and to whom that information was published.
And the fact that he has a mental illness as well might be something that goes into the
systems of discrimination.
Well, also in terms of Article 8 and his proportionality of interference.
And you can do a policy challenge to maintaining the National Extremist Database, a CAPFIR challenge.
Yeah. So then the other question arises, what about the retention of the data and so forth? And clearly there are additional issues that relate to that. What about if they have suspicions, but then they receive confirmation that he does suffer from a mental illness? It's clear he wasn't an extremist. He's not an animal rights activist. Can they just keep that information on the database? Answer is almost certainly no under both Article 8 and the Data Protection Act, particularly under the Data Protection Act. The fourth data protection principle is data needs to be kept up to date. Accurate and up to date, and so that means that it's not static. You have to review what material you're holding about people in the light of the information that you obtain.
Does anyone else have any questions or points about the case study, or before we move on to the second one?
I'd wonder what the approach would be for remedies to the Information Commissioner, even if it's not a direct recovery of damages, there could be a fine.
Yes.
Yeah, so the in addition to the possibility of bringing a civil claim, you can make a complaint to the Information Commissioner, who will then carry out an investigation and make a preliminary finding, and then it's possible for those cases, for those findings to be challenged and taken to the Information Tribunal. So there are other legal, potential legal avenues of redress as well that go beyond the bringing of the civil claim.
And of course, with the Information Commissioner, the irony is that the fine that would likely be awarded if there was found to be a breach by the Information Commissioner would be much higher than any award of damages and the Data Protection Act would like to be. So that's...
Any further questions in relation to the first case study or indeed comments?
In practice, do you find that the source of information is destroyed? And do you have experts like this? Just like hunches of people phoning up, it's not.
I suspect that that the systems in place for monitoring and upkeeping information accurate and up to date are generally very poor with the police.
I mean, just generally.
And
not trying to
just. I think that is a really big issue.
And of course, the only situations you're likely to find out about are either if they use the information in respect of something else and you find yourself on a police list or otherwise because you're on a database, or I suppose unless you're the kind of person that makes subject access requests on a fairly regular basis. But yeah, I think, as Guy says, it's probably more common than not that things stay on the system.
I think it could come up on a PDS. The barring safeguarding.
Sorry.
So if you apply for the barring and safeguarding certificate, that's when you get fine.
Yeah. So people typically find out about their data in circumstances where they're either at the end, they've either been arrested or detained by a public authority, or checks are having to be carried out by them in relation to an application for a job, things like that. And that those are real. That's a real difference with media claims, where the focus tends to be on a publication, and usually very often an individual will not know that a media organisation has been gathering information about it before that moment of publication, where the story comes out. And so those claims tend to have a very different focus. With public authorities, there is always the potential for claims in relation to data being retained and not kept up to date and so forth, but you'll have to do something like a subject access request under the Data Protection Act as a starting point to find out what information is held about you if you have a suspicion that it's not accurate or up to date or records information wrongly. You've got that possibility of doing a subject access request and finding out what they're holding about you. And they're quite cheap to do, I think, only £10 or something.
But take a long time.
Slow.
It's very slow. Anything else before we move on to Daisy?
Sorry, what would the damages be?
Damages for, okay. So if your claim against the council for providing it to the neighbourhood watch, say you were able to establish that that was disproportionate.
Any special damage?
We're assuming there's no special damage.
Sorry, but you calculate that.
I would say we're talking low thousands. I mean, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000. I would say. But I mean, it would depend on all the facts and to how many people it was published and so forth. But that would be my best guess on the current state of the law. I'm going to say a bit more about damages at the end. Against the police for publishing it to the National Extremism Database, I think probably fairly similar, actually, but probably fairly similar. But I think, depending on the number of people that would have access to it and how long it was held and so forth.
So, of course, you might want to look at obtaining some expert evidence on whether disclosure processing has exacerbated his existing condition, because that will obviously give you another head to think things out.
Yes, I mean, if you could make out a claim that that the person involved suffered real psychiatric injury of some kind as a consequence, then you're in a different territory in terms of damages. I was talking about damages for distress and anxiety and loss of dignity, the sort of normal Article 8 parameters.
Anyone else? Shall I move on to
case study number two?
Mr. and Mrs. Jackson and their 5-year-old. So what did everyone think about this? I mean, this is a slightly more egregious and obvious case, perhaps. But what sort of what's the legal framework that you think might apply to this scenario?
Initially, I thought it was the way that the camera retained and processed the data, how long it held on to it, because it's a 5-year-old child.
Yeah.
They expect the child in the data for a lot longer than it is an adult, because she still might be in their care.
Exactly, yeah.
So I think it's accidental loss steps out to prevent
Hospitals
in the
issue. Yeah, I mean, certainly one of the big issues is the decision to just destroy the data in relation to Daisy. So processing, and I haven't gone through this, but processing also includes the blocking or erasure or destruction of relational data. So question whether the council should simply have destroyed all the data relating to a 5-year-old child, certainly without the consent of the parents. Yeah, you're absolutely right, that is one of the headline points on this. And of course, if they're destroying the data, the same principles apply. They still have to do it in accordance with one of the purposes set out in Schedule 2 or Schedule 3. So I don't know if any of you had any thoughts on whether they may be able to get away with it under one of the schedules. This would be sensitive personal data, obviously highly sensitive, relates to a small child. So you'd have to be looking at Schedule 3 in one of the conditions there. And although there are quite a lot of them, including substantial public interest, I'm not sure whether any of those would apply in this scenario, but I'd be interested to hear your thoughts.
I think because Daisy was adopted, I think that's a factor in it, in terms of how information's handled.
Yes.
It's a different situation.
So do you think they'd struggle more to justify?
Maybe. I don't know what policies are for adoption, but maybe, possibly.
Yeah, and we also know from this as well that it was just destroyed because of a technical error. So they've not given any thought to processing at all. It's just simply gone from the system. So I think we probably can all agree that Daisy's parents would have a fairly strong claim under the Data Protection Act for the destruction of all of the information relating to their daughter.
How would Daisy's parents find out? Do they have a duty to tell them?
I don't know, actually, if they have a duty to tell parents under adoption rules and procedure. I would imagine they would have found out by if they contacted the council for information about Daisy's medical history or other information the council would hold. But obviously the council also has to be quite careful as to what information they do disclose about adopted children, just the converse of that. But certainly the information in question here, I would imagine that the parents have simply made a request and that's how they found out.
I think it would at least be arguable that they would be under a positive duty to contact, to tell the parents what had happened. I think it would be, you know, there was a judicial review into the failure by the Met Police to contact people, to have a proactive policy of contacting people whose names were recorded in the notebooks of the private investigator who's working for News of the World. And although JR never sort of got all the way for the purpose of permission, it seems to have been accepted. There's a helpful judgment on that, which suggests that Article 8 can impose positive obligations on public authorities proactively to contact people and inform them in certain circumstances where they are, for example, in possession of information that discloses criminal offence. And if the public authority, as here, appears to have committed a criminal offence under the Data Protection Act,
you can see that there would be at least a decent argument about that. You can have an argument for that.
So how would that, I'm thinking about a circumstance that we recently whereby we came into, some information came into our possession about a criminal offence about a data subject. It was nothing to do with us as an authority, but we came into the possession of some information. And we disclosed this to the individual concerned because we thought that was the right thing to do, as opposed to having any legal obligation to. But it would be interesting if to think about what the legal parameters around that might be. It was to do with some vetting information that we had, that we came across.
And it's difficult.
Yeah, because you hadn't done anything unlawfully with the data.
But we knew a third party was certainly doing something unlawful.
Oh, right.
This individual.
Okay.
Yeah. And this individual didn't know about that.
But I think it's certainly good practice, but you're right, it's interesting whether you'd have a positive obligation.
You'd certainly be fully entitled to under the Data Protection Act, because it would be in furtherance of their legitimate interests. You'd have no...
Yes.
And there's no doubt you'd be able to do that. Whether you'd be required to do that, debate. Sherlock, I know we've got very little time left. I just want to say something very quickly about a couple of interesting areas to look out for. And the Trends in Privacy Awards handout, which is the only thing that I've managed to write in the hours since I learned the terms of what was coming, it relates to this. And very briefly, you can see from page one that European privacy awards tend to be very stingy, and that's partly because the Strasbourg Court usually finds that a finding of a violation is in itself a sort of substantial remedy for the applicant. But you'll see that the levels are really quite ridiculously low. For example, in the Ivy Finland case, where someone's HIV status was disclosed to their fellow employees, or even more extreme facts in the Armenia v. Lithuania case, where HIV status was disclosed in the biggest selling newspaper in the country, and he got €6,500 in damages. So Strasbourg has been extremely stingy, and the extremely stingy approach of Strasbourg influenced the early privacy awards. So if you look at domestic privacy awards, 1 through 6, so from the coming into force of the Human Rights Act through to 2008, they were at a very modest level. And then the breakthrough case, in a sense, was the case of Mosley and Newsgroup newspapers, where Max Mosley's sadomasochistic exploits were broadcast by the News of the World on the internet, streamed to millions of people around the world for them to watch him engaging in his own ritual humiliation. And the findings in that case were that disclosure had destroyed his life. So it was on very extreme facts. But nonetheless, if you look at the 60,000 awarded in that case, it's out of all proportion to the earlier awards. And it does mark, potentially, has been argued to mark a sense of new approach. The subsequent awards, there's relatively little I can say about them. Both Cooper and Turrell and ANA and Associated are slightly problematic judgments for different reasons, but they do broadly are reflective of that upwards trend. 30,000 in Cooper and Turrell was quite a high award, and in AAA, which related to a photograph of a child, of a baby who had no awareness at all that the photograph was being taken, suffered no distress at all, very slightly bizarrely, nonetheless got 15,000 damages. I think on the basis that damages were necessary to vindicate the Article 8 right. However, the Supreme Court, in the case of Lumber, has said that vindicatory damages are not available for infringements of Article 8 rights. So that judgment itself is problematic now. I think the very interesting area is what's happened to the Data Protection Act damages. I'll deal with it very shortly. Johnson and the Medical Defence Union, as Kirsten said earlier, was authority for the fact that in order to bring a claim for damage, a claim for compensation under Section 13 of the Data Protection Act, you need to show financial loss. They interpreted Section 13.1, where it says you have to show damage before you can get damages for distress, as meaning that you have to establish financial loss before you can get damages for distress. That's Johnson and MDU. And that was followed at first instance in Murray and Express newspapers. But the Court of Appeal in Murray and Express newspapers thought that Mr. Justice Lindsay had given an unduly narrow interpretation to the word damage. And that has been reflected in a recent, the key case is the case of Weibel Hall and Google, which is a recent judgment, 2014, it's a judgment of Mr. Justice Tugendhat, and the facts of that case, not a public authority case at all, the facts of the case are that these were individuals who were claiming damages for breach of confidence, misuse of private information, and breach of the Data Protection Act against Google. It related to their internet searches and the fact that their internet searches were being used to then send them targeted adverts. I won't go into all the reasons why the court found that Article 8 was engaged, and most of the judgment is concerned with the issue of jurisdiction. But what Mr. Justice Tugendhat does in the judgment is he sets out the arguments why he personally is persuaded that you don't have to show pecuniary loss in order to recover damages for distress under the Data Protection Act. And the rationale for that is firstly that the Data Protection Act is implementing an EC directive which just refers to damage and doesn't refer to pecuniary loss. And the second is that you end up, that if you do go down the route of saying you have to show pecuniary loss under the Data Protection Act, you don't have to show pecuniary loss to recover damages for infringement of Article 8, or indeed for misuse of private information. So you end up with a potential anomaly where you've got different causes of action which are essentially seeking the same goals, but depending on exactly which course of action is pursued, you can or cannot recover damages for distress. And he found that very unsatisfactory, because what he said is, well, if you've got a claim just against Google under the Data Protection Act, you won't get damages for distress if you can't show financial loss on the Johnson and Medical Defence Union analysis. But if you've got a claim against the public authority, because Article 8 is directly engaged against the public authority, you would be able to get damages for distress. And he thought that anomaly was unsatisfactory. The upshot of all that, and the conclusion is, if you want to bring a claim against a public authority in relation to the Data Protection Act, plead it alongside Article 8. Always include Article 8 in the mix, because you then get round those potential difficulties of the limitations in relation to recovering damages for mere distress. If Article 8 is in the mix, you've got a very strong argument that you're entitled to damages for distress, even if Mr. Justice Tugendhat's observations in Fiedel Hall and Google are not followed. They were just observations. He didn't have to make a finding because it was primarily about jurisdiction. So one of the important tactical considerations when bringing these claims is thinking about how do these causes of action intersect with one another, and generally the best practice is to bring in if each of the causes of action is viable, bring them all in, because they actually complement each other very well at a number of different stages, both in relation to liability and in relation to remedies. And that's it. Thank you very much for attending.